punitive. And so we don't necessarily then respond to the root causes of the conflict. We end up responding only to the action and removing kids from campus or removing kids from their learning environment, which can be marginalizing, especially when the actions that are under scrutiny are subjectively developed. So based upon our ideas about someone's expression or our ideas about someone's identity, rather than whether their actions actually present a threat to safety, to the safety of children and adults on campus. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things are the issues that I try to address in Push Out. But it's also really important for us to think through what this alternative educational space might be, mm-hmm. right? And to really understand that we're operating in a time that, that tends to prioritize punishment over repair of harm. And to me, that was deeply problematic. Because in all of the research that I have engaged in with the girls and in researching for Push Out, you know, just removing a girl from campus or removing a girl from the conflict doesn't resolve the conflict. And so it escalates. It escalates in community. It escalates in schools. And it doesn't do anyone any good.
Right.
There's one example that I include in the book that talks about zero tolerance policies and its particular impact on a girl in Brooklyn who shared that when she was in an altercation with a young man in her class, he was spitting spitballs at her, and you know, her reaction was to tell him to stop, as you know many of us would if somebody were spitting spitballs at you.
Right.
And she got in his face and she got loud and he punched her in her face, and she describes feeling like, you know, well, she describes being taken to the nurse, being escorted to the nurse with her friends, and then also being suspended because she went to a zero tolerance school where if you were involved in the altercation at all, whether or not you actually physically came to blows with that person, because she never hit him back. He hit her. She went to the nurse's office. But because she was involved in the altercation, she also got suspended. And there were a couple of things that I share with this incident. Number one is this was the first of many suspensions for her, because what did she learn from that first interaction? She learned that the school was not necessarily going to protect her.
Right.
She learned that she was going to be suspended anyway. So for her, she interpreted that as, well, I might as well fight if no one's going to protect me and we're not going to have a real conversation about mm-hmm. why I'm having this tension and conflict with this person, then I might as well fight. And she became a fighter.
And she also said it rendered her invisible.
Exactly. Right. And that's my argument, is that it renders, you know, when we talk about, well, the argument is that when we talk about the, you know, school to prison pipeline, quote unquote, and we give these statistics that only prioritize the conditions of males, that a situation like that would render her invisible because we would only see his engagement in this incident and not hers. And yet, this is not the only incident that involves boys and girls in conflict that could have been resolved much differently, mm-hmm. that could have, you know, been an opportunity for discussion, could have been an opportunity to engage in anti-violence and education. I mean, there are just multiple ways that this could have been resolved outside of suspension and removal from school. Mm-hmm. And it especially is important when you're talking about girls who have extensive victimization histories, who learn that that their learning environment is not necessarily a safe space for them. As it should be.
Mm-hmm. Today on the program, I've been speaking with Monique Morris, the author of Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in School, the first trade book to tell these untold stories and expose a world of confined potential, and supports the growing movement to address the policies, practices, and cultural illiteracy that push countless students out of schools and into unhealthy, unstable, and often unsafe futures. It's important to note that Black girls represent 16% of female students, but almost half of all girls with a school-related arrest.
This is KBOO Portland. It is 6:03. Next up, we have queer programming. And on queer program this tonight, we're going to be talking about preference, trans positive, and is it you or is it me?
K KBOO Community Radio is hiring a full-time volunteer coordinator. We're excited to find someone to manage KBOO's volunteer program and be responsible for the day-to-day coordination of volunteers as well as their training. For a full job description and instructions for applying, go to kboo.fm/volunteer-hire-2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/volunteer-hire-2019.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of That's No Lady, That's Darcell, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall in Portland. Walter Cole owned the first Portland coffee bar, then bought an old beer and wine tavern. He began a drag act that, in 1974, became Darcell 15. This musical tells the life story of Walter, Darcell, and more. Again, that's Triangle Productions, That's No Lady, That's Darcell, from September 19th through October 5th at Portland State University's Lincoln Performance Hall, located at 1620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Press Preference. This is your host, Hedda. As Perrin mentioned, this is the Cutie Boo slot. We have three programs that rotate here in the Tuesday 6 p.m. hour. 1 week, it's Preference with me. The next, it is It Me or Is It You? And the third show in the slot is Trans Positive. So tune in every week, 6 p.m. for queer and trans programming here on Tuesdays. And we hope you'll especially be moved to come and join us on the air, listen, and call in. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to launch a pledge drive. And we support this community radio station with you, the listeners. We're independent. We depend on your contributions to make this station operate. And we would love to have you pledge or renew your pledge with us. Before we get started on today's show, I have a couple of announcements. Of course, there's lots of queer programming at TBA, the Time-Based Art Festival that Pikett is putting on. The city's beloved Anthony Hudson gives a talk tomorrow about his performances as Carla Rossi, what his intentions are, what his experiences are. So please go check that out. It's early in the day. That's Pika's, part of Pika's speaker series during TBA. Also, tomorrow is the is the Queer Commons movie series, occasional series at the Hollywood Theater, and Call Me By Your Name is playing tomorrow. And the last announcement that I want to make is that in a couple weeks, we're going to start practices for Thrill the World Portland. This is our 13th year doing a thriller dance. Folks are invited to join us, dress up in zombie costume. We'll teach you the dance, and we'll all come together. We draw about 150 to 200 dancers every year to do this, and we do it in conjunction with simultaneously with thriller events around the world, including Eugene and Camus. Camus does a really lovely performance every year, sort of more intentional and more directed. Anyway, you can check out all the years of our performances online. Just do a search for Thriller World Portland and pick a year from 2007 to 2018. I can't believe we've been doing this for so long. We did it as a fundraiser for SMRC, Portland's Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, for the first 10 years, and now it is a benefit for KBOO Community Radio. So we would love to have you join us in that. Look for Thrill the World Portland on the web and come learn the dance with us. I have in the studio joining me Chrissy Stroop. Chrissy, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thanks for Thanks for being here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. Chrissy, why don't we start with you introducing yourself?
Sure. My name is Chrissy Stroop, as we've already said, and I'm kind of a freelance writer, blogger, commentator. I write for Playboy.com, for Foreign Policy Magazine, for Religion Dispatches. And this last July, I moved to Portland after kind of giving up on getting a tenure-track university job in academia. I have a PhD in modern Russian history, which has opened some doors for me, but, you know, the whole tenure-track university career is basically dead in many fields. And so I've been trying to make it doing freelance work, and I've been gaining some visibility in online spaces, particularly Twitter, because I guess I have a very sort of weird combination of academic expertise and lived experience that allows me to speak to certain problems of our time, particularly the Christian right and the way that it backs Donald Trump. And then also, of course, I have that Russia expertise, and I can bring those two things together. And indeed, I've done that in some of my published research. I know we're going to talk about this too. I've also just begun medical gender transition, male to female. So I was born assigned male at birth, and I'd been wanting to start transitioning for years now, but I just couldn't get to a place in life where I felt like I had enough stability until now.
Thanks, Chrissy. Let's start by hearing about your origin story, your youth. How were you raised?
So I grew up evangelical Christian. You know, it's a pretty strict and extreme version of the faith, and there are more extreme kinds. I didn't get the worst of it, but I was born in a small town in northern Indiana where pretty much everyone is a right-wing Protestant of some sort. Grew up mostly in the north suburbs of Indianapolis and was sent to Christian schools, and these kind of Christian schools, we're not talking about Jesuit academies. They, evangelical Christian schools, they're either church schools or standalone K through 12 Christian schools. They're much more about indoctrination and a much more radical sort of Christianity, and not radical in a good way. So they teach young earth creationism. They very much emphasize abstinence-only sex education when they talk about it at all. They definitely emphasize that good Christians must oppose abortion, must want to ban abortion, must want to oppose LGBTQ rights. And so, of course, you get the idea that good Christians must vote Republican. In the elementary school in Indianapolis, back when I was there in the 1980s, they had one wall emblazoned with the Bible verse, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." So we were very much steeped in Christian nationalism. And when you grow up like this, and your entire social world, for the most part, is people who are either involved with your church or your Christian school or both, you know, even in the suburbs of Indianapolis, Indianapolis itself being not America's most diverse city, but not America's least diverse city either, you know, you're very isolated. And that's so that they can control the kind of information that you get, and that they can try to make sure that you turn out the way you're supposed to turn out, which is very straight, very conservative, very Republican.
Well, I want to run an anecdote by you, or an experience, I guess, that I had a few years ago. I was taking the bus from Seattle back to Portland. And there was a young man, he was 17 or 18, and he got on the bus. And we were waiting in the terminal in Seattle for a bit, and he was openly stupefied by the city. He couldn't understand how the buildings held themselves up. He told me that he had never... And he had that sort of... he didn't have a filter. He didn't have a sense that you know, anyone around him might want privacy. Even in, you know, in public on this bus. So he told me that he had never been above the first floor of a building. He'd never been in a building that was above a first floor, and he had been in this really strong, strongly conservative Christian community, a small town, and he had really, he didn't have the the wherewithal yet to sort of question, but he was aware, at least in some degrees, to the extent in which he had been affected by the formative notions of how people were supposed to be living. His father was gay, and I'm not sure what, I mean, I sort of remember, but not well enough, what had happened. But his father also ended up in prison. And it was, and then his mother, the reason he was coming to Portland was his mother was at OHSU. She had developed cancer. And there was no reason to disbelieve him. He had sort of that fresh-faced, filterless, you know, I'm just going to talk because that's what I do, sensibility. And he reported that his the pastor, I suppose, in his community set a tone, and everyone followed what that tone was. And what the community had decided, I guess, was that his mother's cancer was God's punishment to her for her husband being gay and a criminal.
Oh, that's horrifying. And yet, that kind of thinking is not uncommon in certain kinds of evangelical churches, particularly those with more charismatic practices and Pentecostal churches, prosperity gospel type churches. They believe a lot in divine punishment and blessing being reflected in the events of our lives. And I've heard many stories of people who were, you know, very well respected in their churches until one parent gets cancer or something, and then people turn their backs on them because obviously they've got some sin in their life. I did not grow up with that kind of thinking for the most part. So, you know, there are shades and variations of this kind of Christian extremism, but yeah, that's not uncommon.
Well, let's jump forward a ways. Let's talk about some of what you've been working on. Let's talk about, your evolving relationship to your faith.
Yeah, I mean, these days I call myself a non-religious agnostic, and at the same time, you know, I think, first of all, if you come out of toxic Christianity, a sort of abusive authoritarian form of Christianity, to be angry at Christianity, at the church writ large, is perfectly valid. At the same time, you know, I'm trying to process all of this and looking at the kind of political atmosphere in which we find ourselves now, and I'm trying to build bridges between people who have left these kind of toxic Christian backgrounds for a better kind of religion, and people who have left for no religion, and also in general between progressive believers and progressive non-believers, because I think we need those kinds of political coalitions both locally and at the state level and nationally if we're going to be able to fight back against the theocratic politics of the right that we're experiencing right now. And I do think it's theocratic politics. You hear a lot of pundits say that Donald Trump is duping or using the evangelicals. It is very much the other way around. They're using him to complete and push through an agenda which includes things like, you know, recognizing Jerusalem as the undivided capital of a Jewish Israeli state, because that has to do with their prophecies about the end of the world. And, you know, banning Roe v. Wade, pushing back civil rights gains. They've been working on it for decades. The kind of quote-unquote coastal elite pundits or the chattering classes have, to the detriment of the country, largely dismissed the threat and have contributed to normalizing extremism. And so one thing that I'm trying to do with all of this work online in particular, and with the hashtag campaigns like hashtag empty the pews, hashtag expose Christian schools, hashtag Christian alt facts, is to create the kind of collective visibility of people who lived this extreme faith that people can't ignore, you know, because evangelical leaders of the more respectable variety, they're very good at PR, at cultivating friendly relationships with the press, at getting nice puff pieces written about them. And the press has long failed to listen to critical researchers, you know, people like Frederick Clarkson, people like Catherine Joyce, other folks at Political Research Associates, people like Bruce Wilson, and to listen to survivors. But we're coming into a moment now when, in general, survivors of various kinds of abusive situations are being heard more often. And, you know, we've had decades now of sexual abuse scandals breaking in the Catholic Church. We're starting to see more and more of these scandals breaking in Protestant churches, particularly in the Southern Baptist Convention. And I think part of the reason it's taken so much longer relative to the Catholic Church is that evangelical Protestantism is quite decentralized. I don't know that anyone really knows exactly how many Protestant denominations of Christianity there are in the world, but it's generally agreed they're in the tens of thousands. Some are in the tens of thousands. So there's a lot of different churches out there. It's a very decentralized structure, but you'll find that particularly in North America, because it also represents a certain kind of subculture and ethos, and one that is very defensive and that creates its own institutions parallel to the wider society in order to try to keep the children from, you know, learning things that they should learn. There's a lot of commonalities that people experience through, you know, literature. There's a lot of Christian books published, Christian bookstores, Christian movies. They're mostly terrible, but definitely watch the 1990s version of Left Behind with Kirk Cameron. It's on YouTube. You can watch it for free. You don't have to give these jerks any money. And it's so bad, it's good. Like, it's hilarious. But, you know, they have the Christian schools, they have the Christian colleges, they have their conferences, they have their music festivals, they have the whole CCM, Christian contemporary Christian music industry. They even have their own sort of, like, insurance programs now where they can deny you care for the things that they want to deny you care for. So yeah, there's this whole parallel world, and there are a lot of things that most people who grew up in some sort of like strain of evangelical Protestantism in the United States share in common references and so forth.
When you say, Chrissy, that the press, the mainstream press in particular, normalizes and doesn't question evangelical Christianity, can you talk about more about that? Not only sort of what the substance is. I think you sort of mentioned that sort of an unquestioned absorption and then giving back of these viewpoints. Not only what is that? What is the shape of that, generally speaking? But also, what do we do to push back and create sort of broader narratives that are more honest?
Sure. So many of the people who cover evangelicalism for outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, either are evangelicals themselves or they're very friendly to evangelicals. So right now, you know, Elizabeth Diaz at the New York Times, she's the head of all religion reporting there. And she's an evangelical graduate of Wheaton College. And everything that she writes about evangelicals is very cheerful and optimistic and frankly completely unrealistic. I mean, she writes these pieces where she's like, hey, let's look at these five completely unrepresentative young evangelicals who talk about how, gee, they might vote Democrat, and let's pretend that that's the wave of the future. It's not data-based reporting. She sees what she wants to see, and it's really striking if you look at her writing about, say, some other kind of religion. She's done some great stuff on Catholicism that's actually nuanced reporting. She doesn't do it for evangelicalism because I can only assume she's extremely biased toward evangelicals. And then at the Washington Post, there's Sarah Pulliam Bailey, who you know, does this. She's a Wheaton graduate as well. And she does a very similar sort of coverage of evangelicals in the sense that it's positive. She does take a somewhat different approach from Elizabeth Diaz, who tends to look for like young, hip, cool evangelicals to spotlight and say, look, the church evangelicals are totally becoming normal. It's happening. Everything's fine. Sarah Pulliam Bailey tends to quote evangelical leaders, and she goes to a lot of the same ones a lot. So like Ed Stetzer, who is at Wheaton College, and he's the head of the Billy Graham Center there, or Russell Moore, who's you know, head of the public relations branch, the Ethics and Religious Liberty Committee of the Southern Baptist Convention. And she lets them say things that make them sound good and never probes. So Russell Moore has gotten a lot of credit, some of it beyond what he really deserves in recent years. For initially, he was very critical of evangelicals voting for Trump, But then it seems like in order to save his job, he sort of backed down and said, well, okay, it wasn't a sin to vote for Trump. And he pushes a sort of colorblind approach to racism, which of course doesn't really work, right? So he wants to, he tries to get brownie points, and unfortunately he's often awarded them for being not racist, but he's definitely not anti-racist in any sort of robust sense. And he's also extremely anti-feminist and anti-LGBTQ, and no one in the mainstream press ever pushes him on that. I mean, this is a man who has literally said, it's still up on his website, that feminism is a major problem in the church today and a heresy. He said Christian feminism is a heresy. The mainstream press does not care. Michael Gerson is also a columnist for the Washington Post. He's also an evangelical and a Wheaton graduate. Are we starting to see a pattern? Mm-hmm. Frankly, I call him the Wheaton Mafia. So, you know, he also gets credit for trying to be a polite theocrat. But, you know, he's very mealy-mouthed, and he clearly thinks that we would somehow be oppressing evangelicals and oppressing their religious freedom if we didn't sort of allow them to run roughshod over everybody else in terms of not accommodating people equally in the public square, and things like, you know, shouldn't adoption agencies have to accommodate all comers, or can they ban people of certain religions? Can they ban same-sex couples? He's definitely for the bans. He's for all kinds of religious exceptions, mm-hmm. you know. So just because these people are sort of critical of Trump sometimes and evangelical Trump support, they're given a lot of undue credit by the mainstream press, and they don't talk to enough of us who can tell them what evangelicalism is really like. That is starting to change. Nina Burley at Newsweek has done a lot of coverage that takes evangelical and critical perspectives into account. A lot of the stuff that's kind of critical, it's surface-level critical. It calls out evangelicals for hypocrisy and leaves it at that. But, you know, that's not going deep enough. That's not looking systemically about how white evangelical subculture, conservative evangelical subculture in general, which is mostly white but not entirely, is authoritarian. We were doing alternative facts before it was cool. And, you know, this kind of group is primed to support an authoritarian leader like Donald Trump so long as he pursues their agenda, and he is absolutely pursuing their agenda far more vigorously than any previous presidents, even George W. Bush. Because George W. Bush, at least, was, I mean, he went and started a war in Iraq that nobody needed, but he wasn't going to, you know, sort of unilaterally move our embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem because people who believe in biblical prophecy wanted him to do that. He had enough foreign policy advisors around him who still had their heads screwed on right, you know, to not make a move like that. Trump did it just because he knows his base wants it. And he's also he's attacking transgender health care every chance that he gets. And that's also because evangelicals want him to do that. So what do we do about this? One thing that I've been trying to contribute to is just to create collective visibility on social media in a way that can't be ignored. And sometimes it has worked. I think we're starting to move the needle a little bit. You know, Expose Christian Schools that we did back in January, there were over 200,000 tweets of that hashtag. And there was a lot of furor in the right-wing press, and the hashtag was mentioned on Fox and Friends twice without them mentioning who created it or why. They were trying to paint it as sort of, you know, these liberal elites who don't understand Christianity and they're just being mean to Christians. But we did get into the New York Times, and it wasn't the best write-up in the New York Times. It was very kind of both sidesy, and even to the point where maybe overall positive toward Christian schools. But I think we got a very fair write-up in the Associated Press. So, you know, slowly we're getting certain journalists and outlets like Salon, Paul Rosenberg as well, I mentioned Nina Burley at Newsweek, to understand that survivors of evangelicalism deserve to be heard just like survivors of Scientology. It's a similar kind of extremism.
This question's a little unformed, so perhaps in answering it, you can help me fully make sense of it. When we talk about Trump performing these acts that his base wants, how much of what they want is I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about tens of millions of evangelical Christians right now. How much of what they want is coming from their own experience, their own ideas, sort of how much of it is pushing upwards, and how much of it is the church sort of offering and delivering these ideas and options to congregations?
That's a great question, and it's not an easy question to answer. You know, for many evangelical communities, of course, what the pastor says is kind of the authority. Some are more open in that sense than others, but you know, there are a lot of evangelical leaders who are definitely setting the agenda, and I think that without this huge national media infrastructure and lobbying infrastructure that evangelical leaders have, you probably would still have more diversity among white evangelicals today. You would have more people like Jimmy Carter who interpret their evangelical faith in a very different way from the 78 or so percent of white evangelicals who currently rate Donald Trump favorably. And, you know, that's an overwhelming majority. So you have things like Focus on the Family, Dr. James Dobson, who's been, and that organization has been doing radio programming for a very long time. You have Pat Robertson's media empire, Christian Broadcasting Network, 700 Club. It's been very interesting to see how much CBN has gotten exclusive access to Donald Trump. In some cases, you know, they were part of his entourage on his Middle East trip. I believe they were the only media that were, and this is an explicitly right-wing, you know, radical evangelical Christian media outlet.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Preference here on KBOO. I'm Alan, and we have Chrissy Stroop in the studio with us. Let's talk about what it means to leave. And specifically what that's meant for you and how it's launched the work that you've done since, Chrissy.
Yeah, so evangelicalism in its variations is what sociologists and psychologists of religion would describe as a high-demand religion. It kind of expects you to subordinate your entire life to the dictates of the religion. And because it is also so deliberately insular, you're supposed to go out into the world and convert people, but you're not supposed to really be close to anybody who's not a Christian. And when they say Christian, they mean the kind of Christians that they are. So it's a very controlling environment, and that makes it very difficult to leave. You will definitely have people gaslighting you when you leave if you break some of the biggest de facto rules. You know, you may end up being cut off from your family, or to protect your own mental health, you might have to cut yourself off from your family. It gets so extreme that, you know, there's a whole quiverful subculture, quiverful referring to a Bible verse that describes parents' children as a quiverful of arrows, and it's this ideology that is associated with extreme Christian homeschooling for indoctrinating purposes, where a wife is just supposed to have as many children as possible and homeschool them and, you know, send them out to be culture warriors if they're boys, or if they're girls, you know, stay at home and do the same thing. So in that subculture, I mean, there are even stay-at-home daughters, there's child marriage. And so the more extreme it is, the more difficult that it is to leave. But it's always going to come with a high social and psychological cost. Even if you're in a kind of less extreme version of it, like I was, I definitely haven't had the harshest experiences of it. And yet still, it's been an extremely painful and protracted process for me of losing my faith, because the programming is so intense, and to change your mind on politics or sexuality or anything like that is often seen as a betrayal. So it's just, leaving these kind of faith traditions is rough. And there's been some really interesting research done recently by psychologists showing that people who leave this kind of faith tradition, their mental health often does improve over time. even though being religious in general tends to correlate with decent mental health, and that's probably because religious communities and institutions provide support for people, you know, leaving extremist religious community is actually good for you. But by design, it's very difficult to do because they are authoritarian communities. You know, for people out there who are watching the reboot of She-Ra and the Princesses of Power, I like to say that growing up evangelical is like growing up in the Fright Zone. You know, Hordak is controlling information that you get to the extent that he can, and you think kind of everywhere is like this or no place is better, and you just have to take the abuse. And in my case, it wasn't sexual abuse, but definitely spiritual, emotional. We were also spanked. The worst we got was with a wooden spoon. You know, some kids get dad's belts or worse. So, you know, again, I didn't have the worst of it, but it's a violent and authoritarian subculture. So undoing that, it takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of processing. Getting therapy is often necessary. And, you know, I've been processing it for a couple decades now. I first started asking big questions and having some serious doubts when I was 16 years old, but it wasn't really until about my last year of college that I knew I could no longer believe in things like the Bible contains no errors, you know, what evangelicals call the doctrine of biblical inerrancy. And I voted for George W. Bush in 2000 in the first presidential election I could vote in because I thought I had to because abortion, you know. But by 2004 I voted for John Kerry, and I haven't voted for a Republican since. But it's just, there's so much pressure to conform. It's difficult to describe. And so what I'm doing now, and I have a blog called Not Your Mission Field on my website at cstroop.com, and I'm also at Twitter, on Twitter at @c_stroop. I'm trying to facilitate conversations and to put some thoughts and criticisms out there that might be helpful to other people who are beginning what we sometimes refer to as deconstruction of their religion. It's really important for people to know that they're not alone, because leaving a high-demand authoritarian religious community like this is an isolating process. And it seems like every time we trend a new hashtag, like hashtag rapture anxiety, for example, people who had fear that they were going to be left behind at the end of the world when Christ appears in the sky and takes the believers back up to heaven, or who were afraid of that event, or who were traumatized by 1970s movies about this. So many people said, oh, I thought I was the only one. You know, and so there's certainly something there that's a healing step in just learning that there are so many people who were traumatized by, you know, being socialized in this kind of faith and realizing that they simply could not stay in that kind of faith. For my part, too, you know, I think it contributed to me recognizing that I was queer much later in life than I otherwise could have. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure to conform to strict gender roles in this kind of community, milieu, environment. For example, you know, very strict dress code at Christian school with different standards for boys and girls. Boys couldn't have hair that would extend down past their ears or past their collar. And they would sometimes get called on that and be told to get a haircut. But, you know, girls could not wear skirts that came up above the knee at all. And if a teacher thought it was borderline, she might make a girl kneel in front of the whole class to check and, you know, send her to the principal's office or to the nurse to change if there was something to change into. If the skirt didn't pass the skirt check. So, you know, extreme patriarchal misogyny, purity culture. My whole seventh grade class, at that time we were living in Colorado Springs. So at Colorado Springs Christian Middle School, we were basically, you know, badgered and fear-mongered into signing purity pledges that we would abstain from sex until we were married. We were told not to do anything with a boyfriend or girlfriend that you wouldn't do with somebody else's husband or wife, because you're probably not going to marry that person in the future, so you're cheating on their future spouse and you're cheating on your future spouse. Mm. I mean, it's really extreme and damaging stuff. that happens to you in that environment. So in any case, you know, I clearly was kind of a weird kid, and I didn't fit into the masculine stereotypes that you were supposed to fit into, and sometimes would get teased a little bit about that. But I would just kind of come back with, well, I'm comfortable in my masculinity. But the only thing I ever meant by that was I like girls. And I have been attracted to women more often than men. So that was true. And I could fall back on that and be like, okay, fine, I'm straight. End of story. Moving on. later, I, you know, learned some gender theory, and it was really eye-opening. And I also realized that I can be attracted to men as well as to women. Still hasn't happened as often as I've been attracted to women, but that was really revelatory too, and I developed a crush on a male friend. But this is in my mid-30s that we're talking about, and it was all just repressed before. I don't think it wasn't there. I think it wasn't finding healthy expression.
Chrissy, let's talk about hashtag empty the pews first, and then the anthology you're working on called Empty the Pews.
Yeah, so Empty the Pews is a slogan that I came up with in the wake of the atrocities that were carried out by the white nationalists at Charlottesville in August 2017. And I was just kind of riffing in a Twitter thread that wasn't really pre-planned. And I was thinking about how frustrating it is that evangelical leaders, you know, either weren't saying anything about this, or they were going to the mat for Donald Trump. Robert Jeffress, a major Southern Baptist leader, pastor of First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, was going on TV and saying, Trump doesn't have a racist bone in his body. Everyone stop calling him racist. You know, after Trump made his very fine people on both sides comments, right, and kept dragging his feet about not wanting to denounce white supremacism. So it occurred to me that it's just, I was really frustrated that you can't seem to get evangelicals to respond to any kind of criticism. And then I had the thought, but they are afraid of one thing. They're afraid of declining attendance numbers. They're afraid of losing the youth. So if we tell our stories about leaving these kind of toxic authoritarian churches with hashtag empty the pews, it will send a message. It became a kind of go-to protest hashtag against the Christian right. And, it still gets tweeted daily, some days more than others. But yeah, you can search for that hashtag and you can find a lot of recent stuff. It became just kind of a community thing. And I also use it for some of the swag that I sell in my Cafe Press online store, you know, so you can get an Empty the Pews coffee mug or an Empty the Pews t-shirt and take the hashtag protest offline if you want to. And my friend Lauren O'Neill and I have been working on an anthology of personal essays by former conservative Christians, and it includes ex-Catholics, ex-Mormons, ex-evangelicals, a very diverse group of authors, for several years now. And we finally decided to co-brand it and also call it Empty the Pews. So the anthology is called Empty the Pews, Stories of Leaving the Church. It comes out December 1st with Epiphany Publishers. And we're really excited about that project. There's, if I do say so myself, there are a lot of really powerful essays in there, including a lot of queer narratives. Most of the essays are by women. There are some very powerful essays by gay men. We also have some essays that focus on kind of more the global aspects of this, or those that have to do with migration and immigration and missionary projects. There's a fascinating essay in there by a Singaporean woman about growing up in an American-style prosperity gospel megachurch that sold American books and American sermons on tape in Singapore.
That's Empty the Pews, out in December. And the you sent me the website, a webpage that has the list of authors, which was really a treat to see. Looks like it's going to be very interesting.
Thanks. Yeah, you can go simply to emptythepews.com, and that will redirect you to the website that the publisher built for the book.
You've used the phrase Christian public sphere. Can you round that out for us?
Sure. So public sphere in general refers to the kind of area in which we talk about society and politics and policy and debate things, the kinds of things that you're supposed to do in a democracy. It would cover things like, you know, news coverage, reporting, as well as editorializing, commentary. These days, I would say the social media is definitely part of the public sphere. And in a democracy, we really should have, you know, religiously neutral public space. We ought to have the kind of space where, not to say that you have to drop your religion or the convictions that come from it when you enter into public debate, but simply that everyone has to be equally accommodated there, because we live in a pluralist country, right? Not everybody's a Christian, not all Christians are the same. And the reason I talk about the United States having a de facto Christian public sphere is because I think it's a problem. I think it often goes unnoticed. It contributes to the normalization of extremism in the media that we've been discussing. And it's simply because, you know, Christianity being the majority religion, and particularly white Christianity, is privileged in our society. We can talk about Christian privilege as something similar to white privilege or male privilege and so forth. So the phrase came up in this recent article that I wrote for Playboy.com called The Gospel According to Mike Pence. And I wrote this in July after Mike Pence visited one of our border concentration camps, and the conditions were horrible. Everyone could see from the footage and the pictures that they were horrible, and he told everyone it's all fine, perfectly fine. And so a lot of people started tweeting fake Christian at him, and it trended. And I understand the sentiment behind that, but I don't think that's the most helpful way to criticize Mike Pence. I think, in fact, that if you're using a term like fake Christian to describe this, you're essentially saying that real Christians never commit atrocities. All real Christians are good people. And this isn't what you want to do, but that plays right back into the hands of the Christian right. Because, you know, the newspapers are not going to agree with you that Mike Pence is a fake Christian. They're not going to agree with you that evangelicals who support Donald Trump are fake Christians. So if you're supporting a framework of Christian moral supremacism, you're just contributing to, you know, the persistence of our de facto Christian public sphere. And you're not helping us to have instead a truly pluralist secular public sphere. Why are we debating theology in the public sphere? The thing about Christianity and any religion is that it's a complex cultural system. It's historically, socially, communally mediated in the tradition, the history, the texts that we find within Christianity. There are a lot of different materials from which to construct an interpretation. And so it's possible to have good, progressive, inclusive Christianity. And I'm not saying that's fake Christianity. It is also possible to have truly illiberal, imperial, anti-democratic, downright evil Christianity. And we shouldn't say that's fake Christianity either. They're both versions of Christianity. And as soon as you say one is fake Christianity, you're both supporting Christian moral supremacism. So you're basically saying Christians are inherently more moral than atheists, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, anyone else, which is probably not what you want to be saying. Certainly not if you believe in democracy and human rights and equal accommodation. And you're also entering a theological debate. So keep the theology among, you know, Christians themselves. Keep the Christian inside baseball within Christianity. You want to criticize Mike Pence in the public sphere? Criticize him for being a terrible person, but don't say he's a fake Christian. You can be a real Christian and a terrible person.
Thank you for that. There's a lot to chew on in that. A little especially so for me because I'm not Christian, and so I don't... it's difficult for me to figure out where the lines are or how to think about Christianity.
Yeah, it's a question that a lot of people have. And to my mind, I just don't think that outsiders need to be drawing those lines, with maybe very few exceptions. So as long as you have a kind of coherent community claiming to be Christian, and they have some kind of relationship to the Bible, some kind of praxis, so they have a kind of communally mediated interpretation of the faith, I'd say that's a group of Christians.
Yeah.
And, you know, outside of that, I mean, if I start to tell you that, you know, Christianity means you need to stand on one foot every Tuesday at 3 p.m. for 15 minutes, I mean, you can say that's fake Christianity because it's completely made up. It has no relationship to the Christian tradition. But evangelicals, as right-wing nationalists as most of them are, they are a part of the Christian tradition. They read their Bibles. And in fact, this is glossed over so many times in the press, but it needs to be emphasized. Among white evangelicals, frequent church attendance correlates with a higher rate of favorability toward Donald Trump. So it's not just the cultural ones who don't go to church who support him. It's actually more those who really take their faith seriously and go to church every Sunday. They're the ones who support him.
Going back a moment, has there been a response from any church leaders to empty the pews so far?
Yeah, there has been some. I was interviewed about Empty the Pews, the hashtag campaign for Sojourners magazine, which is a progressive evangelical outlet. I've also discussed it with Reverend Dr. Welton Gaddy on State of Belief Radio, which is syndicated in a number of markets in the South. He's one of the good Baptists, one of the Jimmy Carter Baptist style Baptists, and I just love him. I love talking with Welton Gaddy. He's a great guy. So people say I hate all Christians. That's definitely not true. Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson has also tweeted the hashtag, and he sometimes combines it with a hashtag that he created, hashtag White Church Quiet. So, you know, he's someone coming from the African-American social justice preaching tradition who sees Empty the Pews as a valid approach to the horrors of much of white Christianity in America. And I've gotten to meet him in person. He's a wonderful man. So when I talk about trying to build bridges between non-religious people like me and religious people, I do put my money where my mouth is. I have worked with or given talks for humanist organizations, but also for organizations like the Indiana branch of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. And they brought in a national leader from that organization, Reverend Dr. Kerry Jackson. And we had a great conversation about Christian supremacism in the United States. So, you know, now have evangelical leaders directly responded to it? Mostly no. Ed Setzer used to talk about ex-evangelicals on Twitter sometimes in a kind of condescending way, naturally, and then he blocked most of us. Mm-hmm. So he's a big snowflake, Ed Setzer, as they all are. You wouldn't expect them to respond, but you know that they're paying attention.
Let's talk about what's happening on Global Crossroads. I was listening today to an episode about the family. We don't need to dig into that particularly, although it's pretty fascinating. So folks can check out what's already up on SoundCloud. But what are you working on?
Thanks. Yeah. So Global Crossroads is a new project of mine, and it's one where I get to wear my foreign policy hat along with two other hosts of this new show, Deirdre Sugiuchi and Deepak Singh, who are friends of mine. And it's in the podcast, we're looking at issues of global concern. So things like climate change, violence against women, right-wing populism, international right-wing networks, religious conflict, and all these sorts of themes through interviews with experts and also with people who have lived very international lives. So far on the show, we've had Mona El-Tahawi, the Egyptian-born feminist who is the author of a book called Headscarves and Hymens. And then the episode that dropped today features Jeff Charlotte, who his book, The Family, came out in, I think it was 2008, where he looks at this kind of secretive elite fundamentalism at the heart of power in D.C. He's got a Netflix docuseries now that he produced that has revisited that work and also brought it up into the present, and I definitely recommend watching it. Jeff Charlotte is really, really sharp guy, and we had a great discussion. So yeah, check out the podcast. On Twitter, it's at crossroads_pod. And yes, we host it on SoundCloud. It is now also available on iTunes and Spotify.
And it's called Global Crossroads.
Yes.
We just have a couple minutes left. Do you want to share some closing thoughts with us about where you are and where we are?
Sure.
And what comes next?
Well, for my part, I'm getting ready to hit some conferences this fall. I'm going to be at the Religion News Association in Las Vegas later this month, and I'm excited about that. And I'll also definitely be tweeting and writing about how things go with my gender transition, and I hope that doing that so publicly will have some benefit for maybe trans kids out there who are in difficult situations. And I do plan on working towards a book of my own, as well as a single author book rather than a collection with multiple authors like the one that's coming out in December. I want to kind of do a history of, say, the last 40 or 50 years of the culture wars. This thing where the Christian right just really radicalized, crystallizing about 1980 and leading to them going all in for Donald Trump. But I want to look at that through the eyes of survivors who have left and rejected it. And so there'd be a lot of interviews that would serve as some of the material for the book. But much like I do on my blog, I would contextualize those interviews with, broader look at the historical and social context that matters for these sorts of things. So hopefully kind of paint a generational portrait that way. I also hope that's what Empty the Pews, the anthology, does in some ways. You know, kind of paints a portrait of a generation in flux. And those of us who are leaving religion, we are about a fifth of the population now and on the rise, and particularly among young people. There are more and more non-religious people all the time.
1 in 5, huh?
Yeah, about that, about 20%.
Interesting. And it is a rising number?
Yeah, there's been a huge uptrend in people who check the box for no religious affiliation, the so-called nuns, not N-U-N nuns, but N-O-N-E-S nuns, because we have some sociological research to indicate that it has been the rise of the Christian right and its extreme culture warring and power politicking that has really psychologically damaged so many kids many of us are speaking out now. That's what's driven a lot of people away from the church, that and the sexual abuse scandals and these sorts of things, which I think is ultimately healthy.
Hmm. Well, I think we're going to hear a smidge of music. Is that right? All right, good. This has been Preference. Chrissy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
Cstroop.com, is that right?
Yes, that's my website.
All right, fabulous. Get a hint and links to everything you're working on and your writing there. We're going to be back. Preference is going to be back in 4 weeks with an interview I've been waiting 25 years for. We're going to talk with Patrick Califia. Very excited. We're going to hear a little bit of Trey Pearson's song, Hey Jesus. Thanks, everyone.
Can you hear me now? It's been a while since I came out. I was wondering, do you love me the same? You see, I've loved you since I was young, tried to be the greatest son. Now I'm wondering, could they love me the same? 'Cause I know that I could never change. I tried so hard, brought so much pain, and I just wanna be loved for who I am. I know that I could could never change. I tried so hard and brought so much pain, and I just wanna be loved for who I am. I just wanna be loved for who I am. Change. I tried so hard, brought so much pain, and I just wanna be loved for who I am. I know that I could never change. I tried so hard, brought so much pain, and I just wanna be loved for who I am. Wondering, could you love me the same?